Major funding for the connection is provided by Macromedia, the software company helping to redefine what the web can be. Available on the web at www.macromedia.com.
I'm Dick Gordon. This is The Connection. Well, it might be the aggressive slap of dominoes in China, or the rattle of backgammon dice in Cairo, or the squabble over who gets to be the shoe or the wheelbarrow setting up for Monopoly in Cedar Rapids. The history of such games, especially board games, parallels the evolution of human intelligence. And this is no trivial pursuit. From the hollowed rocks of Africa comes a game called Mancala. From the hills of Mesopotamia we find the royal game of Ur. And on down the line, civilization has expressed itself through board games, marking commerce and morality through a competition fought with dice, spinning wheels, letter tiles, and chessmen. Experts say that the games we play today carry with them the original stones, the markers, and strategies of the past, all the while reflecting the particulars of the contemporary. Witness the holistic pitch for the hot new game Cranium, a game its backers claim will restore the brain to its rightful status as the body's most popular organ. So what's the place of the board game in your history? Is it just a winter evening diversion, or is it a marker in some way of our morals? And what do the games we play reveal about who we are? Our number's 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Now, we will start with all of us standing on the square marked start and roll the dice to see who goes first. The play will then proceed counterclockwise. No, I'm just kidding. My first guest is Dr. Irving Finkel. He is the assistant keeper of the Department of the Ancient Near East at the British Museum. He's also an expert on the history of game boards going back 5,000 years. Welcome to the program, Dr. Finkel.
Dick, I'm glad to hear your voice. How are you?
I'm well, thank you.
Splendid.
I want to hear the story of the royal game of Ur from you. This was discovered, I gather, in the early 1920s by Sir Leonard Woolley in a cemetery, but he didn't know how to play it.
That's correct. In fact, for the historian of the board game subject, Woolley's discoveries at Ur were magnificent because they found five beautiful boards which were buried in the graves when the Sumerians went to their final play of rest. And it's obviously a very popular game at that period. And many people had sort of ideas about how this game was played, and lots of things were written about it. But I had the great good fortune to discover in the British Museum that one of our cuneiform tablets, and we have 130,000 of them, actually has the rules on it for how the game was played. And it took me a long time to decipher these rules, but in the end I managed to do it, and we can now play the game much as they did in about 2600 BC.
That's more than 4,500 years ago.
A good bit more, but actually I must put the thing on a clearer stage before we go much further, because the oldest games are a good deal older than that. Archaeologists who've been working in the Middle East, in Syria and Jordan and Israel and the Lebanon, have found Neolithic gaming boards, which go back to between 6 and 7,000 BC, a good bit earlier than the Ur board you mentioned. And these are the oldest ones that archaeology has provided for us. And we don't know, of course, how they were played, because there was no writing and no other evidence. But they're flat pieces of stone with three rows of holes on, and they looked for all the world like examples of Mancala, but of course I don't think they can be, but it looks like it's the kind of game where you put things in the holes as you might do in Mancala. Now, so games go back to at least 7,000 BC.
I suspect you have something in common with all of us in trying to decipher the cuneiform instructions for the royal game of Ur, because we've all wrestled with the instructions in a new game.
Well, the fact is, actually, when people buy a game from a shop, they never read the rules anyway. They just take the pieces out and they start playing. And then when something goes wrong, someone says, perhaps we ought to read the rules. And that's usually a few days later, from my experience.
Do you see in... Oh, I should mention for our listeners that we have a link on our website to an interactive version of the royal game of Ur. So while you're listening to us, you can go to that website and take a look. It's quite a beautiful game, the way it was built and designed.
It is, actually. The one that we used as a model belonged to a royal family, and it was inlaid with very precious materials. But we also know that it was played by people in the street, because there are scratched boards on pavements and bricks and things like that. And we can show from archaeology that this game was played down until about the time of of Jesus or so, then it dies out archaeologically, but it resurfaces also much later in India, and it looks like the game's been played continuously in some part of the world since the middle of the third millennium, which is quite a record, really.
Is there anything in the game that is parallel to games that we still play today?
Absolutely, absolutely. I mean, it's a race game for two opponents. They have the same set of pieces on each side, and you throw your dice and you move the pieces around the track, and it's the first to get them off the end. And this is a kind of pattern which is easily paralleled by lots and lots of modern games too. You know, there are squares which are lucky, where you get a second throw, and there are other kind of nuances, but in fact, if you do get hold of this game and read the rules, there's nothing there which will strike you as bizarre or very ancient. It's quite a familiar kind of almost modern game in its principles.
But the interpretation of the cuneiform that you did also led you into some of the strategy, which tells us how the game was played and what the sort of intricacies of it were at the time.
Well, the nice thing about the rules is that what they do is they teach you not only how to play the game, which is, of course, everybody knew already, but if you want to play it for wages, if you want to bet, it teaches you the special values that all the pieces had, because in the later period, towards the end of the first millennium, about 300 or 200 BC, when the rules were actually written down, the pieces had got more complicated, and people used to bet so you could win things. And the rules are written in a rather funny way. They don't just say you win this or you win that, but you say you get enough beer, or you get enough meat, or you get enough for young women. They have a kind of code of values, and you have to interpret it. It's written in a rather poetic and fancy way. It took me a long time to decipher it, I can tell you.
A game for men, I gather.
I think largely so, yes.
And when it was in India, was it did it change there? Was it still a little bit of a gambling game, a poor man's game, a rich man's game?
Well, by the time we got to India, it was taken by the ancestors of the Jews who live in Cochin today. And there are still some elderly people in Cochin who know how to play this game. By this time, all that nasty wager material had been purged clean, and they just play it probably as it was originally, a kind of family race game, and it was just the first to get the men off the end who was the winner.
Now, one of the things that you were mentioning to people here at The Connection is that morality has a role, even in some of the earlier games.
This is true. The best example is the game of Snakes and Ladders, which, of course, is much later. I believe it's played in America under the name Chutes and Ladders. I don't know why. Perhaps you don't have good and convincing snakes in America. But the original game was Snakes and Ladders, and this started off in India probably in the 18th or the 17th century, when the game was used as a kind of deliberate moral instruction technique. The board was laid out with 100 squares, but different from modern boards that we know in the West, each square had some writing on it, and it said things like uprightness or stiff-neckedness or evil, and if you were one of the evil people, you went down a very convincing snake to the bottom and you had to start again. But if you were the kind of person who was upright and of a high moral tone, you went up the ladder, and the ladders go and bend in very peculiar places, but eventually, if you're successful, you get to Nirvana. And there's a good deal of written evidence to show that this game in India, when it started out, was used to teach children the difference between right and wrong and how good behavior is rewarded, or at least it's supposed to be rewarded in life.
This is probably a good time to bring Margaret Hofer into the conversation. Margaret is Associate Curator of Decorative Arts at the New York Historical Society in New York City. She's organized a current exhibit called The Games We Played, featuring 150 board games made and played in the United States from the mid-1800s to the 1920s. Hi, Margaret.
Hi.
What is it about Snakes and Ladders? Did the Puritans want the snakes off the board? Is that what happened?
I'm not sure what happened to the snakes and the ladders, but certainly the concept of vice and virtue did stay on in American games. And one of the earliest of American board games, called The Mansion of Happiness, is based on a similar concept. You land on spaces denoting a virtue like honesty or piety or humility, and you advance towards the mansion of happiness. But if you land on a space denoting a vice like drunkenness, idleness, or audacity, you don't advance, or you even get sent to the whipping post.
But how can it be then an issue of morality if it is chance that takes you to this place of morality or this place of depravity? Was it meant to be something that sort of looked into the player's soul? Aha, so you've lost the game, that means you're a bad person?
Well, I don't think it was that deep. I think it had instructional value, so that young people playing the game would learn that certain behaviors led to
a better life.
Punishment or
all right.
And good behavior led to advancement.
It's quite realistic, because in life, good behavior is not always rewarded so visibly. And if a chance element comes into the teaching of morality, this might have a benefit too. You never know.
Let me hear from both of you, though, about who played the games. Because often in reading about the old games, you're hearing about adults playing them. But then we see them today very much as something that children play. Margaret, what about that?
Well, the earliest games in America were marketed really to adults, and families played them. But since in the 18th and early 19th centuries, the children were just viewed as small adults. These were not marketed especially towards the children. It's really in the later 19th century when you get games that are really directed towards children. They're based on fairy tales and nursery rhymes, mm-hmm. and they're didactically instructional.
Irving, what about the sort of international history of games? Was there this back and forth between children and adults?
Well, I think in antiquity, board games were exclusively played by adults. I mean, a lot of our evidence comes from tombs, of course. For example, from ancient Egypt, people were often buried with a board game, which they would need in the next world. And all the evidence shows that it was an adult activity, not a children's activity. Kids played with marbles and pull-along toys and dolls and things. But I think children playing games is a very much later thing. Certainly in Britain, in the 19th century, there's a parallel to what Margie is talking about. The earliest games which were inflicted on children must have been horrendously boring. You get these dull maps of Britain, and you can imagine children probably having to be rapped over the knuckles to keep their attention on the board. They were relentlessly tedious.
Irving, it sounds like you suffered that yourself.
Well, not that old, but I must say, I have seen them in museums and looked at them with horror.
But it sounds in a way almost like a lesson, though, that the game is structured in a way like a creative school lesson where people are supposed to learn something. Margaret,
well,
is that
in principle? I'm sorry to interrupt you. I think in principle games are for entertainment. I think the instructing side of it is a kind of offshoot in a way which surfaces at different times in different societies. But the basic function of board games is entertainment.
And yet, Margie, you're saying that there's a fair amount of educational in some of the early games in America.
Yes, I think it's very true that American board game manufacturers tried to further the point that games instilled moral values in children, and they were good for individual children and for the democratic nation. That a nation of good moral children helped us all. So that there was a lot of idealism in the overall concept of game playing.
Connection listeners, what about you? Did you learn your moral values by stacking up the hotels on Pennsylvania Avenue? Or do you reflect back on games that were somewhat important in your youth? Our number is 1-800-423-8255. I'm Dick Gordon. This is The Connection from NPR. Listening to The Connection from National Public Radio. I'm Dick Gordon. Our number, 1-800-423-8255. Join our conversation about board games. Aaron has. He's calling in from Brookline, Massachusetts. Hi, Aaron.
Hi, how are you doing today?
I'm fine. Thanks for calling.
Thanks a lot for taking my call. I'm about 28 years old, so I kind of grew up with video games, right, starting with the Atari 2600. And for years, throughout my adolescence and up into my early 20s, I played them constantly. And I started realizing as my life got more complex that he took a lot more of my time. So a few years ago, mm-hmm. I kind of gave him up, and I got back a lot more into board games and things like that.
Like which ones, Aaron?
Well, Monopoly's always been a big favorite of mine.
Yeah.
How can it not be? But I've also liked games like Clue. I've also been into the more traditional games like chess, and I really, I'm not very good at it, but I'm really into the game of Go, which is a Japanese board game. And more recently, actually, I've come across a very interesting game. It's very interesting in the fact that it's the players don't work together. They don't work against each other. They all work together to beat the game. And I kind of looking around into the deeper aspects of the gaming world, it seems that there's a lot of these really amazing game designers who are applying their intellects to designing very complex games. And I think the best thing about all this, and especially about this game I'm talking about, is that human interaction is something that really doesn't happen in video games. And even with the online gaming world, you may, like, interact through the internet, but...
Was that it, Aaron? Were you discovering, finding out that you were talking to yourself too much playing all the video games?
Yeah, it's kind of, you know, it's this enforced sort of solitude that you have. And it's fun in a way, but I also found it was a lot more like an addiction. And I'd be in front of the TV screen for hours and hours, and you kind of cut off from the world. Whereas just spending like an hour or so with my wife or with friends playing a board game, it, you know, you're laughing and you're talking, you're having fun. And it's just something that's, I think, a lot more representative of what we're losing in today's world, where we're kind of getting more detached from each other and using technology to communicate with each other.
This is radio, but I can see Dr. Finkel nodding his head in approval.
Well, I couldn't agree more. I'm delighted to hear an expression of such a clear philosophy, because it's usually the other way around with people. But I think that the interaction with a human rival is infinitely more satisfactory than with a computer screen. And there's also a tangible physical pleasure in moving manufactured pieces on a wooden board and thumping them down when you've made a good move and staring at the person to try and intimidate them. And all these factors, I think, give an element of enjoyment to games which are completely lost in the field of computers. You know, I often talk about games, and people always stand up and say at the end, do you think that the computer will mean the death of board games? And I always resolutely say no. I don't actually wear a T-shirt saying board games live forever, but I always strongly support the idea that they will last forever. It's very interesting. To finish the point, in the shops in London now, obviously all working hard for Christmas, board games are all over the place. And it's clear that for many people, both on the selling end and the buying end, they are a natural thing to give as a present for families and children. And I think this encapsulates the truth that they have a role in society which will never be supplanted by electronics.
Well, if I could make another point before I leave, I was wondering if I could say something else.
Shoot.
I heard somebody put once, like, talking about chess or something. It's very interesting to see physically what's happening on the board, but especially when you're watching a long chess match, somebody's kind of likened it before to you're watching something that's happening on somewhat of a metaphysical plane, because you're watching two people engaging their minds with each other and kind of wrestling on this different plane of existence that you really can't see physically, but you can kind of experience the energy of that while you're watching somebody play the game, you know?
Which lets the spectators in.
Yeah, exactly. So it actually is interesting if you can get there as a spectator of a chess game, whereas, you know, a lot of people will say it's boring to watch chess, but if you can kind of approach it from that viewpoint, I think it becomes very exciting.
My favorite one, Aaron, is watching the old men play dominoes and how fast. I mean, you see that in Southern Europe, you see it in Asia, but I mean, that is a spectator sport, with the real slap of the tiles and the strategy that's going on, which is way too fast to follow.
Right, just like if you watch Blitz Chess in Harvard Square, you know. So, anyways, thanks for taking my call.
Thanks.
I'm really enjoying the topic.
All right, it's nice to hear from you.
I'd like to add something about this return to traditional board games that I found very interesting. Apparently, there is a surge in interest documented by the toy industry. And after September 11th, between the third and fourth quarters of 2001, there was an almost 400% increase in sales of family games. And in other periods of American history, for instance, during the Civil War and during World War I, there are surges of interest in board games. And I think it's very interesting that people turn to them for distraction and also maybe for a feeling of togetherness.
It's got to be something more than nostalgia if it goes back as many thousands of years as it does, though, Irving.
I think it's a human given thing. You can hardly point to a society either in the modern world or in ancient times where there isn't a board game played by people. Anthropologists say that no one plays a game in Oceania, but my feeling is that it's about time I went to Oceania because I bet I could find something. I think it's a human universal. I'm interested in what Margie says. You know, there's a dark side to this same issue, of course, that when you have war and other such disasters in human society, people manufacture board games for propaganda purposes. For example, the Nazis in 1938 produced a rather disgusting game called Judenrausch, which was to snatch Jews out of where they lived and send them off to their premature end. And this was distributed and tried to be put into people's houses. And it does illustrate the kind of reverse side of the coin that, historically speaking, board games have been used for propaganda like that.
Well, Margie, and you have some examples in your exhibit of the less attractive bits of American past.
Yes, we have a number of racist games in our exhibition. We've included African American stereotypes, although there are many others. If you look carefully through the games of other types of stereotypes, but the African American ones are so blatant and so shocking to our eyes today. It's really hard to believe that in the 1880s and right around 1900, when we have laws legislating equality, that the imagery and the wording can be so blatant and so derogatory, and so sadly reinforcing of negative stereotypes.
Our telephone number is 1-800-423-8255. Let's go to Worcester, Massachusetts. Paydar's on the line. Hi, Paydar.
Good morning.
Thanks for calling.
Coincidence or connection, I don't know which word to choose. This morning I began reading the poet Basho's book, The Road to the North. And he began his journey with a haiku comparing the winter sky to the stones of gold. Just a comment.
This is something that I'm going to let Irving help us out with. People seem to have a lot of interest in this game, Go, which is much more popular in Asia, isn't it?
Yes, well, it started in probably in Japan. It's played in Japan and China and Korea on a national level. They have a Dan system of awarding points to distinguished players. And periodically, there have been attempts to import it both into Europe and into America. So in both places, there are Go clubs where people struggle to master the game. It's a very curious phenomenon because it's a game where you can learn the rules in half an hour, and then you have to devote the rest of your life into mastering the strategy because it's immensely complicated. And it's a very serious intellectual game and well worth learning. And its use as an image occurs in many poets in Japan. They draw analogies from the pieces about life and so forth. But Basho is a good example of it.
But do you suppose that there's anything to the design of games which makes them appeal to certain people in certain places? I think of the Russian affection for chess, the Asian passion for Mahjong or for Go.
It could be. I think one of the salient points about being a good Go player is you have to concentrate for a long time and you have to be patient. And it's probably true to say that there are relatively less people in our part of the world of whom those are, who have those characteristics in abundance necessary to pull it off. It's a remarkable thing. Go on, yes. What we can say?
No. Go ahead.
No, I've tried to learn the game because I've tried all the games that I've come across, and I know people who play it seriously, and I've seen it played in clubs in Japan, and you have a room full of people bent over a board in total silence for an entire afternoon, which is not something you see very commonly in human society.
1-800-423-8255. Peter, thanks for that poetic reference there to Louisville, Kentucky now, and Brad's joining us. Hi, Brad.
Hello.
What's your game?
My game is a child game, the game of life.
Oh, I remember that, with the little mountain spinner in the middle.
Yes.
Now, why does that stick in your mind, Brad? What is it about that one?
Okay, Monopoly would be my favorite. But life sticks in my mind because every time that you went to play that game, when you were a little kid, it was your first chance to go and be somebody. And to experience life, you know, you're not just in the basement anymore. You're a doctor or you're an artist and you don't make much money. And then everybody gets equalized in the end, you know, and then they're all the same value at the end of the game. And then they have to, no matter what they were, it's all how they lived their life.
And you got married and picked up kids and stuck them in pins in your little car along the way, right?
Did it all in the game. did none of it in life, see? I played it all in the game so far.
I want to hear from Margie on this, because Margie, back in the mid-1800s, Milton Bradley had a game called The Checkered Game of Life. Are the roots of Brad's game in that?
Absolutely. The Game of Life that Brad knows was issued in 1960 to commemorate the 100th anniversary of the Checkered Game of Life. Mm. But it was a complete redesign of the game. The Checkered Game of Life, which was Milton Bradley's first game in 1860, was very much one of these vice versus virtue games where it was a checkerboard game board where you'd make your way to from infancy to happy old age, but you'd be sent back if you landed on the gambling space and
proper
excuse me?
No, I was just saying proper thing. Go on.
That's right. And then it was completely redesigned in 1960 for that anniversary, and it's so interesting to compare because money is a big part of the game of life. I think you get a certain amount of money for each child, and
remember that.
Yeah, yeah.
They've even changed the 1960 version now.
You've seen a modern version, have you, Brad?
They've changed it still. Now you have a picture of your house, and it shows you how much your house costs, and it goes from the version of an aluminum trailer, which isn't very much to look at, but it's you spend the least money of everyone.
Right.
And to the big elaborate mansion that's a couple of $100,000, and you lose it either way. But people that I played the new game with all wanted the trailer because they only wanted to spend like the $15,000 and be done with it. And when I was a kid, it was completely opposite. Everybody wanted to be the most and the biggest. And now when I play that game, everyone's very frugal and they don't spend money like they did.
Interesting. Well, it's a classic American game to be based on money and the accumulation of wealth.
Well, if we go, we only have to look back in the last century, Margie, to games which were purely about that, games of sort of the game of the district messenger boy, how to be a CEO, yes. In effect, right?
Yes. It's so interesting. In the 1880s, which was a decade of economic expansion, a whole new type of game developed, and it was basically the rags to riches theme or the Horatio Alger story where you start out at the bottom of the ladder, you're the gopher, and you rise to become president of the firm. And there were numerous examples, numerous spin-offs of this same type of game, one of the better known being the game of District Messenger Boy. But the basic message was no matter what your origins or your status, you can rise to the top, and that theme really pervaded American games for a long, long time, and is still in many of our games today.
Now, Irving, certainly. In your list of classifications, we have the race games like the Royal Game of Ur and the battle games like chess, and then there is this one called accumulation games, like the one that Margie's describing. Is that a relatively new phenomenon?
I think it is. I think we ought to say, however, that the celebration in America of the issue you've just been talking about, which is personified by Monopoly, Monopoly was never invented for that reason, because there was a wonderful lady called Lizzie McGee, who in 1904, she was a Quaker in Maryland, produced a game called The Landlord's Game, which is the direct ancestor of the modern game of Monopoly. And her motive for producing this game was to inveigh against people who speculated in property. It was a morally orientated, deliberate piece of propaganda against buying up small businessmen. It's not what it became. Unfortunately, there was an individual called Charles Darrow, who in the 1930s got hold of one of Lizzie's boards, sold it to Parker Brothers, became a multimillionaire, and got all the credit for inventing this game, and of course turned it around so that what it does is it celebrates the worst elements of human behavior in the most violent possible fashion. I mean, if you see Monopoly played in our house, perfectly civilized children turn into monsters within seconds, people stamp on the board and all that kind of thing. We've developed, I have to tell you now, has a special technique for annoying people at Monopoly, which is very useful. When they go bankrupt and they sell everything off and give you all the money, you take the money and you count it incredibly slowly in front of them, all the way through the pile to the end, while they're getting more and more angry. And then when you finish, you do it again to check, like in the bank. And I guarantee that if the person is under 21, they will then stand up, kick over the board and run out of the room saying, I'm never going to play Monopoly with you ever again.
Which is the intention.
That's the intention. That means it's a really good game.
All right, let's go to Maynard, Massachusetts. Dave's on the line. Hi, Dave.
Hi. A nice segue based on that last comment. I just wanted to bring up the point about how board games can tell you a lot about your childhood. I was raised with four brothers, very competitive. The object of the game was to crush your opponent into complete humiliation and tears. Exactly. Otherwise, you didn't completely win. And
it wasn't
my wife.
Any... Go ahead.
Yep. And my wife, who got along very well with her sister. You know, they used to play for fun, and her sister and I played Monopoly one time, and we're going around the board, and her sister didn't have enough money, and my wife said, oh, don't worry about it, pay me next time. And I just went into a rage. I just, you know, this is not how you play Monopoly. So I just thought it told a lot about relationships with siblings. And also, I just wanted to put in the plug for my favorite board game, which is Risk. You know, global domination. There's nothing finer than that. That's a great game.
I remember it well. Dave, thanks a lot for your call. The way boys and girls play games. Quite different, Margie.
Yes, although during the period of our exhibition in the 19th century, there's very little differentiation between girls' games and boys' games. With the possible exception of war games, which are clearly intended for little boys. They're very interesting because today's parents would gasp and frown upon the grisly, gory details and the whole idea of celebrating war. But a very interesting subsection of games that really doesn't exist anymore in that blatant fashion.
Some of them do, like Battleship, though, the sort of hidden, where do you shoot, where do you find the battleship? That still lives, does it not, in some
right,
form?
Right, sure,
I think the British version of that is Stratego, but I'll have to check with Irving when we come back after the break. Our number is 1-800-423-8255. When you're bored, do you play a game? Is it a board game? What's your board game? And what does it teach you about who you were and who you are today? 1-800-423-TALK. I'm Dick Gordon. This is The Connection from NPR.
Funding for The Connection is provided by Macromedia, the software company helping to redefine what the web can be. Available on the web at www.macromedia.com.
From Boston University.
Board games, the topic of our conversation this hour, 1-800-423-8255. You're listening to The Connection from National Public Radio. On one side of the board, Margie Hofer. She's Associate Curator of Decorative Arts at the New York Historical Society in New York City and has organized a current exhibit called The Games We Played, American Board and Table Games from the Lyman Collection Gift. And it was, in fact, to close in January. Margie, I understand it's been extended through to mid-April. Is that right?
That's right.
So there you go, a chance to see that. On the other side of the board now, Dr. Irving Finkel, assistant keeper in the Department of the Ancient Near East of the British Museum. Did you come up with that title just so your business card would be difficult?
Actually, our business cards are printed in invisibly small writing, so it makes no difference at all.
In 1991, Irving translated a tablet in the British Museum that helped explain how the royal game of was played. And you can do that, in fact, yourself or with a partner, by going to our website and finding a link to the interactive game. In fact, we've got a lot of images there, slides given to us thanks to by Irving of some of the old games, if you want to explore some of that. Now, I do have to check with you. Stratego, is that Britain's battleship?
Well, we have battleships in Britain, but I used to be at school with a piece of paper and another piece of paper on top, so I've never seen a commercial version, but I chiefly work in things which are BC rather than AD. We better ask Margie about it, I think.
Oh, all right. Big difference, though, Margie, between names of games in the United States, names of games in Britain. They do change a lot.
They do, but But many American games are, especially early in the 19th century, are direct derivations of English games. I think it wasn't until the 1880s or so when a real American game was developed.
All right.
And before that, they just copied the English games and changed the names.
Let's continue our conversation with our callers by going to Watertown, Massachusetts. Michael's on the line. Hi, Michael.
Hi. When I was much younger, around 1972 or so, my brothers and I played, well, what you might bivalently call a race game called 50 Steps to the White House. It was released under the aegis of the actor Godfrey Cambridge, and the goal was to get a black man into the White House.
Oh, it wasn't a race game.
Interesting.
And there were two paths. You could be a moderate or a militant, and I can't remember much more about it. But it made me think the landlord's game never got us Georgian single tax, and I think Judenrass had to be given away. I was just wondering if any overtly political games have ever become actively popular by themselves. Because
you're not including Risk there, the global domination.
Or Mystery Date, for that matter.
Okay, Irving or Margie, any idea whether or not the type of overtly political game that Michael's referring to, did any of them ever catch on?
I can't think of an example. I must say I'd like a copy of this Lighthouse for the British Museum collection. It sounds remarkable.
Yeah.
The title, again, was 50 Steps to the White House.
To the White House, yeah.
And it was, again, Godfrey Cambridge gave his imprimatur to it. I doubt he came up with it.
Right.
It had a large illo in the middle of some people painting the White House black.
Right.
And I remember it being pretty funny.
Huh.
Thanks for your call, Michael. Hi. We learned something. To Medford, Massachusetts. Adam's joining us. Hi, Adam.
Hello, hi. How are you?
Fine. Thanks for calling.
I have two questions for your guests. One is there's a book. It's an excellent book. It's called The Player of Games, and the protagonist is sort of the world's greatest game player. And in the book, they make a distinction between mechanistic games, whose rules and outcomes are mathematically determinable, like chess, and games with an element of chance that's unescapable. And the protagonist considers those to really be the only true games. And I was wondering if this resurgence you've been discussing includes both varieties of games or just one or the other. And then the second question very quickly that I had for you was I've noticed in recent years a dramatic upswing in the number of packaged games which are given a board but for which the board is completely extraneous. And your parents always say, oh, we used to play that game with a piece of paper and a pencil. And it seems like it's just been packaged with a board because people need the board and the dice for some reason to give it a you can win this rather than just participatory. So those are my two questions. I'll listen off the air. Thank you.
All right, Adam, thanks for your call. Let's start at the beginning, if we can. Irving, perhaps on this mechanistic game versus the games of chance, is that a distinction that works?
Well, it doesn't work in antiquity because all games were games of chance in antiquity. Chess is the first game which breaks away from it when it's a war game between matched sides. But the mechanistic element, I think, is something which is really much later, and we ought to have a word with our colleague here about it.
Well, there are many, many, many American games that are based on chance. And the board game manufacturers were really interested in selling games, and they put a lot of energy into creating beautiful box covers and not a whole lot of energy into creating complex games. So the vast majority of games in the late 19th and early 20th century, and I think going right up to today, are variations on a very simple race game where it's chance. It's the throw of the dice. They're all variations on the same. And I think this question about whether the resurgence is really of the chance games or the mechanistic, I would say really it's the chance games because it's those games that are being recreated over and over and over in different packaging. The games like chess, families tend to have a chess set and keep it, whereas the multiple versions of the basic race game with variations, people will buy again and again just for the variety.
I do actually know exactly what Adam's talking about when he talks about the packaged version of parlor games, you know, whether or not it's the one where someone looks up a word in a dictionary and everybody's supposed to make up their own definition. I mean, you really can play that with five pieces of paper, or you can spend $30 on buying a box and little pads of paper that allow you to do exactly the same thing. Is that a trend, Margie, in your view?
Well, I think there is a trend towards families are doing family game night. We actually do that in my family. There's a trend going back to traditional games. And I think some people are a little at sea. And because we've had several decades dominated by video games, I think there's some parents with young children who may not really know how to pull out a couple of pieces of paper and do a simple board game, and they need the help, or they right. feel more confident purchasing a packaged game.
The packaging is like a picnic hamper. You know, if you open the lid and take things out and unwrap them and everything, it has a mystique about it, which is something that the commercial interest makes the most of.
It also wraps well.
Yes.
Let's go to Barrington, Rhode Island. David's on the line. Hi, David.
Hi there. I find it such a fascinating and exciting subject to listen to. I've been a game collector and hobbyist almost all of my life, I would say. I'm 42 now. I started probably when I was 10 or 12. I'm buying my first, shall we say, serious game. It was an Avalon Hill board game, which I must have played once or twice in my whole life. And then I moved on to the role-playing games, and all this concurrent with video games as they were getting more and more complicated.
So what's your favorite, David?
Well, it's hard to say, because I find that over my life I've totally changed in what my desires are. I'm right now very, very into playing they're commonly known as the European-style games. And a whole new wave of games over the past 4 years that have come from designers in Germany and France and are usually either imported or reissued with American text. And it's the interaction between people at the table that really excites me the most. I, like the earlier caller, burned out completely on late night computer games, the great thing about playing with four or five other people is that usually someone will conk out and everyone will wisen up and go home without having to stay up for that little next level.
Let me ask Irving in on this. Why it is that the simpler games are the ones that survive? Is it because the pieces don't get lost? Is there something more metaphysical to it than that?
No, I think it's because the simpler games exemplify very simple principles. I mean, if you look at games in a global sense, they, as you indicated before, divide quite neatly into different categories. The race is one of them. War is another. There are hunt games. There are three games in a row. They are all, in some way, or can be seen as a sort of sublimation of hostility and excessive energy in people. And they embody simple matters, simple forms of competition. And these things never change because they're human things. And that's why so many modern games have these essential principles behind them, I think.
Margie, in your experience, when you trace the history of the games, do you see a trend that we can track past us and on into the future, or is it always a reflection of what society is?
Well, I think board games definitely reflect the society that produced them and that played them. No question about that. But there are also certain elements of games that live on through the centuries, and that I think will be with us forever. Certainly, the competitive nature of games that's so clearly embodied in American games is thriving, and I can't imagine will ever subside.
What's your first choice for games night at the Hofer household?
Well, I have to admit, Monopoly is one of our favorites. There's also a new game we enjoy a lot called Apples to Apples, which is not a board game, but more of a card game.
Irving, I'm just a sort of thought from you on what it is about Monopoly that is so popular when so many games have been produced? What was the sort of magic concoction that worked in that one and keeps working today?
Well, Monopoly, if you look at it, if you're an archaeologist, if you excavate a Monopoly set, it looks like a race game when you have cars and irons and what have you being first round the track with the pieces. So it derives from the elementary idea of a race game round a track, and in that way it's a bit like the old game of goose, which existed in Europe a long time before. But the unique thing about Monopoly, I think, was the idea that you could own the squares, you could buy the squares and own them. That was a very brilliant invention, and it gave the whole very simple plan a whole different slant, which, as I said before, locks into this kind of need among human beings to show their worst, I think. It's a remarkable phenomenon. I mean, Monopoly has spread around the world. It's one of the world conquerors and is right up there with chess and backgammon and other things like Pachisi. It differs from them in that it is a commercial invention. It's not something which has ancient roots, really. But, you know, it exists in virtually any country you set your foot in, both official versions and pirate versions. We have in the British Museum some wonderful examples of pirate monopolies from India and Sri Lanka and places like that, which are spectacularly beautiful.
But it seems to sort of stand in a way at a crossroads from games of chance, games where you matched wits or your luck against someone else, to a game that had money at the heart of it. Is that a reasonable observation?
Yes, it's a diabolically successful mixture, and I don't suppose anything will ever come along to rival it. I know people in Britain who make games and manufacture them, and when you mention Monopoly, they all go pale and hold on to the edge of the table. And I know that they get submitted to them endless games by mad inventors who think they thought of something wonderful. And in the old days, like when Monopoly itself was invented, they gave them scant attention. But now everybody is looking for what they conceive of as another Monopoly. It's, you know, it's a world conqueror of unsurpassed quality.
Well, I wish you luck in your next trip into the cuneiform vaults, in case there's a game that we haven't yet discovered. Is that possible?
I don't think so, unfortunately, but I'll keep looking for you.
Thanks so much for being on the program today.
Pleasure.
Irving Finkel, Assistant Keeper, Department of the Ancient Near East at the British Museum. Margaret, thank you for being with us.
Thank you.
Margaret
Hopler
is Associate Curator of the Decorative Arts at the New York Historical Society. She organized the current exhibit, The Games We Played, which is on view through April 13th. 2003. You can, of course, continue the conversation at our website. We're at theconnection.org, and you'll also find a gallery of many of the games that we've been talking about, and as I mentioned earlier in the program, a link to the British Museum site where you can download an interactive version of the Royal Game of Ur. It is digital, but can still be fun at the same time, if not taken in great long doses. 1-800-423-8255 is the number to call. Mark it down. We expect to hear from you on tomorrow's program. You're listening to The Connection from National Public Radio. I'm Dick Gordon.
Funding for The Connection is made possible by Macromedia, the software company helping to redefine what the web can be. Purchase cassettes and CDs of The Connection, please visit www.theconnection.org or phone 1-800-909-9287.
This is W.